Just yesterday, we met a rancher whose grandfather established a family ranch in Fort Klamath back in 1898. Family farmers in the Midwest might have a name for that kind of agricultural operation, Young. Some families can trace their relationship with the land back many, many years. That does not necessarily make the job any easier. The earth may be giving, but not always forgiving. We get a sense of what it's like to work the land on a small scale in a book by Ted Genoways called This Blessed Earth, A Year in the Life of an American Family Farm. Ted Genoways is a journalist who lives in Nebraska himself. He won a National Press Club Award for his coverage of agricultural gag laws, Ag Gag, for Mother Jones. His previous book was also farm-based called The Chain, Farm, Factory, and the Fate of Our Food. Ted Genoways, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
So at the outset, was this a search for a sample family to tell a farm story? Did you find the family first? How did that go?
Well, it started actually with my wife and I. My wife is a photographer, Marianne Andre, and we often work together. And we had been covering the Keystone XL pipeline and the path that it was slated to take through the state of Nebraska. And we were interested in the fact that the farmers and ranchers in Nebraska had been really the sole group along the route that had organized in time and with enough vehemence that they had been able to delay the project. And so we were interested in the families who were at the front of that fight against the pipeline, seeing, you know, a group of farmers and ranchers in a state that is thought of as being incredibly Republican, opposing a project that was being spearheaded by those sorts of interests. And in the course of doing that research, we met Rick Hammond and his daughter Megan Hammond, who had land that had sat on both of the routes that had been proposed for the pipeline. There had been a reroute that had been proposed by TransCanada after there was objection to the first route through the state, and the Hammonds had land on both the first path and the second. And so we were interested in them for that reason to start with, but the more that we got to know their family, the more we were struck by how many global issues, international trade and policy issues seem to run through their piece of ground that otherwise seems to be a sort of remote and isolated spot in the middle of Nebraska.
And you do a very good job tying the economics and the policy and international relations with grain and all of that to the life of Rick Hammond's farm that obviously works with his daughter Megan and Kyle Galloway, her boyfriend. And one of the things you remind us quickly about farm economics is that people don't necessarily celebrate a great big harvest.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that always, when you see the farm reports and they're talking about it being a record-breaking harvest season, it seems like the sort of thing that should be great news. But the reality is that if everybody is producing at record levels, that means that the supply is higher than it's ever been, and that, of course, is going to push prices down. And so farmers, though they are reluctant to talk about it, are always at this time of year hoping that their yield is high and that there are unforeseen problems that have emerged in other places, that there may be hail damage that was undetected, that there may be just simply overestimates of the yield in other places. They would never wish anything bad, of course, on their neighbors, but there's also this recognition that the way that the system is set up, you are essentially in competition with every other farmer who's growing the same commodity grain that you are.
Now, we mentioned Rick Hammond, the patriarch of the family farm here, his daughter Megan here. There's the issue of succession, you know, who the next generation taking over the farm. We had the maker of the film The Last Crop on a year ago by the very same subject. I mean, succession is a big deal on a farm.
It is, and it's getting to be a bigger deal all of the time. I mean, in the last 30 to 40 years, the number of people who are actually on the land and participating in farming has dropped by almost 75%. So that means that there are fewer and fewer people engaged in agriculture, even as we are farming increasing numbers of acres for commodity grains and also producing more than ever before. So that means that at the turn of every generation, that there's a lot at stake, that there's the operation of horses having to get bigger to keep up with that pace, and it means that you have to have kids who are coming into adulthood and are ready to take over an operation that requires them to be able to do everything from repair a piece of farm equipment themselves by hand if they have to, but also be making decisions about what seeds they're going to purchase and plant based on projections for international commodities trading 6 months down the road. And not surprisingly, that's a pretty remarkable and unusual skill set, and it means that that over time, as things have mechanized and industrialized, more and more kids who grew up on the farm have decided instead to go find work in the city.
You know, the whole issue of production and what to plant and how much is such an issue that I hadn't considered until we talked to somebody else a while back. And she mentioned that you got to remember that when a farmer makes decisions about production, they have no idea what the marketplace is going to be like when those crops come out of the ground. And so that's an amazing thing to think about. And it's one of the things emphasized in Ted Genoway's book, This Blessed Earth, A Year in the Life of an American Family Farm. We'll come back and talk more about the Hammonds of York County, Nebraska, when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is the journalist Ted Genoways. He lives in Nebraska with his wife, Marianne Andre, who is a photographer. And they together covered the Keystone XL pipeline machinations and ran across some farmers whose land the pipeline would have crossed in two of its iterations. So they got to know Rick Hammond, his daughter Megan Hammond, her boyfriend Kyle Galloway, and got to know a lot about farming in that part of the country and just the general issues that face farmers still working on a small scale in the middle of the country. Ted Genoway's book is called This Blessed Earth, A Year in the Life of an American Family Farm. And you can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. As I understand, Rick Hammond actually paid a bit of a price for his opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline. How did that manifest itself, Ted?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So Rick had been pretty vocal about his opposition and not just refusing to sign the easement on the second route that would cross land that he thought was just too valuable to his operation to put at risk. But he really did a lot of work trying to persuade his neighbors as well. Put up signs, placed an ad in the local newspaper explaining his opposition to the pipeline. And one of his neighbors, from whom Rick had rented land for many years to farm as part of his operation, objected to Rick's stance on the pipeline and decided that he wasn't going to rent that land to them anymore. And it came at a time that was kind of tight for the family operation anyway, and losing that land, not having that piece of ground to be part of their operation, really put the clamps on their business for the year, and it just happened that was the year that my wife and I were with them, following them, and seeing, you know, how they struggled through.
You mentioned the issue of succession. I mean, Rick Hammond is getting pretty old to be working a farm himself, so he wants to hand it off to Megan. And the process of handing it off to Megan and potentially Kyle, it seems to have some more complications than just regular succession. What are those?
Well, succession is complicated always because of, you know, the size of these operations, and there's tax issues, there's questions of how the land will be divided among the siblings, which ones may want to actually work on the land, which ones may want to just maintain a financial stake, those that may want to cash out and sell to their siblings. So there's always lots of family dynamics there in the first place. But things are are particularly complex, I think, at a moment where so much of is at stake, but also the factors are changing so rapidly. It's a time where the technology that is being implemented on the farm is just radically different than it was even 10 years ago. There's a moment early on in the book where Rick is showing me how the auto steer works on the John Deere harvester.
Auto steer. I couldn't believe that. He's punching in stuff on a computer screen in the cab of his tractor.
That's exactly right. And it's all set according to the planting lines that were established months earlier when the field was planted. And the harvester, using the same database and the same information, knows exactly the pattern that the field was planted in, but also the seed density, the exact number of seeds and where they were placed. And then as it harvests, it is, you know, collecting the data on how many, in this case, soybeans are being harvested, and is able to tell you in real time whether that particular spot in that swath that you're passing is at the expected level of production, above or below. And so as the farmer is moving, as Rick is moving across the field, he's able to see in real time whether he's making a profit or taking a loss.
Well, and I'm impressed, though. I mean, not only the technology, but in combination with ancient skills. I mean, farming is essentially as old as dirt, and so there's still a human brain in here making educated guesses. Like Rick has to decide which kinds of soybeans to plant, how fast they'll mature, when to harvest them, what the moisture is in them when he's taking them out. There's just all kinds of considerations that have to go on the human end that the machine can't do for him.
That's right. Yeah, the everything is so incredibly precise now that one of the real pitfalls for individual farmers of how industrialized and precise, I mean, precision farming is what big agribusiness talks about these days, that, you know, you're trying to manage the amount of what they call inputs, which is to say anything that costs you anything, herbicides, pesticides, water, you know, even the fuel that you're using for planting and for harvesting. You want to keep all of those costs down while you're maximizing output, you're maximizing your yield. And to figure out the best way to do that, yes, these farmers are in consultation with agronomists from the seed companies and with consultants, often from the ag extension of state colleges. They may hire their own consultants. But in the end, they are the ones who have to decide, this is the variety of seed that I'm going to select. I'm going to plant it at this time, and I'm going to plant that in this field and something different in the neighboring field. And it's all based on their own estimates of what the weather will do and what the markets will do months in advance.
Ted Genoese is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He writes about farming on a family scale in the Midwest and Nebraska, specifically in a book called This Blessed Earth, A Year in the Life of an American Family Farm. In talking about trying to outguess the market, and in the book, Rick Hammond and Kyle Galloway are finishing up a grain bin so they can store soybeans on the land in the hope that the market will come up to a point where they can sell them for a profit, which makes me wonder, do farmers quietly hope for a problem on some other farm that lowers the yield and therefore raises the price?
Well, very quietly, but yes. I mean, you don't ever want to wish anything explicitly bad on your neighbors, right? I mean, you don't want your friends to be struck by hail. But if there's some rootworm that takes out somebody in South America, or there's a drought that strikes someone several states over, and that pushes prices up in a way that makes your operation just a little bit easier to keep afloat that year, that is something that really is just a reality. And I mean, it's no different than any business in that way, that if what you're producing is a product that in many ways is identical to what your competition is producing, then the only thing that you have going for you is scarcity. And so you're always hoping that you're producing in a year when your competition wasn't able to. And of course, what farmers do is they push toward increased yield. They say, you know, I'm not hoping for anything bad for my neighbors. What I'm hoping is that through my own skills and my own wits, that I can produce more than anyone has before, and then everybody wins. But in reality, it's scarcity that produces the market trends that allow individual farmers to thrive.
But I can see this is sort of like the way that the OPEC countries kept pumping out oil, even though the price had dropped greatly on the world stage, is that you can't afford not to produce. I mean, you as a farmer, you have to produce something in order to make money. You can't just stop and expect to make a whole bunch on the little bit you produce because you created scarcity.
That's exactly right. And so so every year, every pressure, every incentive pushes toward increased production. And so we have every year these announcements of a new record-setting yield, which is good for the livestock feeders, and it's good for the companies who are hoping to export grain, and frankly, it's good for U.S. foreign policy, where we are hoping to have some dramatic influence over the grain markets because of our overproduction. But at the farm level, that increased production means that farmers are often having to invest more and more, which is to say take on more and more debt every year just to stay even with the production of the rest of the industry.
We learn a whole lot about farming on a family scale in York County, Nebraska, and therefore, by extension, to a lot of other small family farms around the country. In Ted Genoway's book, This Blessed Earth, A Year in the Life of an American Family Farm, maybe you have some questions, maybe you have some experiences on farms to share with us. We'd like to hear from you on The Exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We did talk about soybeans. Soybeans and corn alternate on the Hammonds farm, but here's a name I did not expect to see in this book, Henry Ford. How did he figure prominently in the American adoption of soybeans?
Right. Well, one of the surprises of the narrative, I hope, is that that Henry Ford really turns out to be the father of the American soybean. That at a time when Henry Ford was recognizing very early on that he needed to find some petroleum alternatives in order to not only fuel all of the machines that he was manufacturing, not just cars, but also trucks and tractors, but also, you know, so many of the parts of those vehicles, from the paint to the steering wheel to the shifting knob, are made from petroleum compounds. And so what he was doing was looking for some sort of an alternative. And so he had a research team that was looking for, you know, plant-based alternatives that could get high alcohol content out of a field crop, and ideally something that then could be, you know, used in multiple applications. And what he found that was by far the most productive was the soybean. And not only did the oil that had been removed from the soybean work extremely well in all of the industrial applications, but he found that the meal that was left over from the milling and refining still had high protein content and could be sold to animal feeders. And so it really became this ideal crop, and especially became important at a point when we started hybridizing corn, making corn drought resistant and hardier. But what hybrid corn has done from the very beginning is use tons of nitrogen from the soil. And soybeans are actually natural nitrogen fixers. So by alternating corn and soybeans, you could put the nitrogen back into the soil that you were going to need for the corn production, and you also had this new crop that, in the midst of the Depression and the Dust Bowl, did well under those conditions, and produced a crop that had multiple applications in order to assure that the demand would be high.
But the demand for soybeans didn't get quite as high as Henry Ford had hoped. What happened?
That's right. Well, so he had all kinds of uses for it, and he, you know, was such a proponent of the soybeans that, you know, his employees complained that, you know, they got rid of cow's milk in the commissary and replaced it with soy milk, and, you know, he was wanting the soybean to be used for absolutely everything. But just as it was starting to take hold that we could use it for petroleum alternatives is when oil was found in Saudi Arabia. And that discovery, the discovery that there was that reserve and similar reserves all across the Middle East, pushed prices for petroleum much, much lower and really undercut the market for the fuel alternatives. And so, but at that point, there had been so much push toward starting to raise soybeans and to mill them and process them that everything moved away from the industrial applications and moved heavily toward using soybeans for animal feed.
Well, you know, you can see through this story why farmers and their supporters want new markets for crops all the time. And it helps explain things like ethanol and why all the people from Iowa fight so hard for it. It's because you just can't feed people that much corn. As somebody points out in the book, stomachs are not infinitely elastic.
That's right. Yeah, and so the move is always toward trying to find new markets, new applications, and you know, I think we tend to think of the farmer out in the field raising food, and even when we're seeing fields of corn, that we're thinking of that as being, you know, the sweet corn that winds up on our dinner table, when in reality it's feed corn that is primarily being used for livestock feeding, but also has other applications like ethanol, as you say, and other industrial applications. And so what you're seeing is not really intended for human consumption at all, but for all sorts of other applications.
So we're talking to Ted Genoways about his book, This Blessed Earth, A Year in the Life of an American Family Farm. This particular farm had an issue with some bugs. Stem borers began to show up in some of the soybean plants. And this brings up the whole realm of crop insurance and all of these programs to help farmers defend against losses. I mean, how much do they have to pay for crop insurance in a given year, and how much does it pay out when they do have damage?
Well, it's all incredibly variable. It's like any other insurance. You can, you know, take out insurance that covers a lot of your loss, and you know, most of the insurance will cover up to 75% at the sort of top premium level. But you have to pay, of course, then monthly premiums that are also at that level, and then there are additional supplemental coverages that you can get to cover individual kinds of losses, hail damage or insect damage, drought loss. And so you're always, again, making a calculation as you look at a year and say, you know, do I want to take out insurance that is full coverage but is extremely expensive on the front end? And then if you have a year where there are no problems, then you've paid all of that money unnecessarily. Or do you want to take the risk and say, you know, I don't think I need to get a lot of insurance. The weather looks like it's going to be good, and you know, I think we've got our insect problems under control, and risk having a year where, as you say, the stem borers were showing up in Nebraska for the first time at that point. And so this was a brand new problem to have to deal with. And the Hammonds had been warned about it by the Ag Extension agronomists, had said, you know, it's moving forward and we expect to see it sometime in the next few years, but they hadn't expected to see it so soon.
So, Ted, and we're getting close to a break here, so a somewhat shorter answer, but does Rick Hammond keep really detailed books, records, databases, or does a lot of the stuff, does he have to just kind of juggle it all in his head as he goes through a day of farming?
it's remarkable how much of it is computerized these days. I mean, not just, I mean, Rick does keep a lot of it in his head, but it's also stuff that's getting entered into a database, and the numbers are being crunched all the time, and with assistance from the government and from companies and from the universities. Everyone's involved.
Ancient skills and modern technology combining in 21st century agriculture on a relatively small scale. It's still a family farm we're talking about here. Ted Genoway's book is called This Blessed Earth, A Year in the Life of an American Family Farm. We'll come back and talk more about the Hammond Farm in York County, Nebraska, when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to the journalist Ted Genoways, who lives in Nebraska, with his wife Marianne Andre, who is a photographer. They covered the Keystone XL pipeline issues together and met a few farmers along the way, some of whom really didn't want the pipeline on either one of two routes going through their land. Those included Rick Hammond in York County, Nebraska, and his daughter Megan Hammond, in the process of trying to figure out handing off the farm to the next generation, and the process of handing off the farm and just dealing with farms at a family level became a whole book for Ted Genoways called This Blessed Earth, A Year in the Life of an American Family Farm. You can join the conversation on the Exchange, share stories of your own farming experiences, ask questions of the author, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So I mentioned a couple of history lessons in here. Henry Ford and soybeans was one of them. There's another very important one here. Earl Butts and the upsizing of agriculture, turning food essentially into a weapon by his own terminology.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, Butts was, he was the Secretary of Agriculture under Richard Nixon. And Butts was, an incredibly outspoken figure and not at all shy about saying that his intention was to essentially weaponize American food production, and that his goal was that we could so thoroughly overproduce key grains that it would push down the global market for those prices for those grains, and make it so that the Soviets and the Chinese could not afford to produce their own grains, and so they would acquire from us. And his notion was that this would make our enemies dependent on us for food in the same way that OPEC nations had made us dependent on them for our fuel.
So which means that we got, go big or go home was essentially what Earl Butts was saying as the agriculture secretary. So we now have these huge players, not entirely because of his remark, obviously, but like Cargill and Archer Daniels Midland. So in this economy, who do the small farmers like Rick Hammond sell their stuff to?
Yeah, so there's the players that you're talking about that have become incredibly diversified. And so a company like Cargill that started as a grain producer has moved into meat production and egg production and, I mean, just every sort of agricultural realm. And so they have captured as much of the market as possible at the same time that they have asked the farmers who are working and selling to them to become more and more specialized in their operations. So it's while Rick doesn't have a direct contact with or a direct contract with Cargill the way that some beef producers do, when he goes and sells his cattle at the sale barn, some of the large presences at those places are buyers for places like Cargill, who are always on the lookout for animals that they can bring into feedlots that they control and get bigger, or animals that are market ready that they can load up and take to the processing plant. So there's that on the one side. On the other side, with the grain production, when Rick is selling his commercial crops, he's taking things in and selling them at the local grain elevators. And essentially what they're doing is following the Chicago Board of Trade and the prices that are set for those grains on any given hour, and making their own decisions about what they can pay in order to continue to make a profit as an operator themselves.
So you could go to a grain elevator on Tuesday and be paid a different price for your grain than you would have been paid on Monday or the previous Tuesday?
Absolutely. And I mean, you could be paid a different price in the afternoon than you were paid in the morning, and you can be paid a different price at one elevator than at another one 10 miles away. So what they're always doing is, again, in the modern age, there are iPhone apps for all of this. There are ways for them to be checking the prices at surrounding elevators and watching the prices at the Board of Trade and making decisions about the best price. And it's not always as simple as saying, well, I'll take the elevator that has the highest price, because you may be in a field that is 20 or 30 miles away from the elevator with the best price. And the cost and fuel to get there and the time that it costs you in the middle of harvest to get to some place that has a slightly higher price may not be worth it. So there are market calculations that are being made minute to minute out in the field in the midst of the harvest season.
As you look at the history of farm outputs in America, it seems like we get overproduction and a crash and overproduction and a crash. Is it that simple? Are the cycles that regular?
Well, unfortunately, it's not quite that simple, because what ends up happening is that there's overproduction, a crash, and then there's some attempt to make adjustments. And that happens at the governmental level. It happens at the business level. And typically those things start to lead toward renewed increased production. But often there are minor adjustments that make it so that all of the factors that are playing into it are not the same as they were last time. So it's not as easy as just anticipating where the market is going to crest or what the problems may be, because you have something. I mean, the most recent example of this that it has been really potent for farmers was when the EPA decided to enforce the renewable fuel standard. It was passed in 2005. There had to be a certain level of renewable fuel by 2007. And in order to meet that demand, everybody recognized that the only way that it was going to be possible to hit the standards was through ethanol. And so everyone invested heavily in ethanol, and everyone knew that those ethanol plants were going to need corn, and they started planting corn, and the prices for corn skyrocketed. And it was really an unprecedented situation where farmers thought, well, this is a godsend. As prices went from where they had been for decades at $2 to $3 a bushel up to $6, $7, and finally $8 a bushel. But when the government said, this is too high for corn, and actually corn got so expensive that the ethanol producers couldn't afford to buy it, there wasn't enough margin in it for them to make a profit, and it was causing problems for animal feeders and all of those sorts of things, the government then stepped in and adjusted the renewable fuel standard, and prices crashed. So it can be just as much a factor of well-intended adjustments to supports for farmers that you know can create boom times, but they can also create huge crashes.
Wow, it's just amazing the way you can tweak demand on one end and tweak supply, and not always at the same time, and end up with vastly different results at different times in history. So we've definitely got into the economics of this. I do want to talk a bit about the chemistry of farming. There's a long section here about the hybridization of seeds and other technological marvels. On Rick Hammond's farm, what do they think about herbicide use and Roundup Ready GMO crops and all that?
Well, I think the feelings there, like on so many farms, is complicated, because on the one hand, genetic modification has especially allowed the reduction in the use of pesticides, and that's a serious issue, especially in the part of Nebraska where the Hammonds are farming. There have been a couple of now much studied clusters of neurological disorders that researchers believe is tied to the application of certain types of neurodisruptors that were used as pesticides. And so anything that allows you to be reducing the number of chemicals that you're spraying on the field is seen as a net positive. It's something that you're not going to be exposed to, your family's not going to be exposed to, but also not, you know, your neighbors and your community. The challenge is that when you are hybridizing and then genetically modifying the plants in order to get certain yield results, you don't always know exactly what that is going to be doing in terms of soil demands and in terms of the other kinds of requirements then to keep those plants healthy. So if you figure that one of the things that's been focused on in the last generation is density, being able to hybridize and genetically modify toward a plant that will tolerate being planted virtually on top of another, that means that you've got a whole new set of interesting problems. On the one hand, if you've got three times more plants on a piece of ground than you used to have, you're almost certainly going to have to apply fertilizers because there aren't enough nutrients in the soil to naturally accommodate it. But it also means that you're probably going to have to irrigate that field. And in years past, you could simply irrigate from top down and count on those droplets making it from the top of a corn stalk all the way to the ground. But if the plants are too densely planted now, new systems are required. And there's been a move toward having center pivot irrigation systems that have nozzles, hoses that hang down to get them closer to the ground. And more farmers are now moving toward underground irrigation systems because they want to maximize the efficiency and make sure that the water is making it to the plants. So every adjustment that is intended to increase production and therefore improve the bottom line for the farmer, it can very often end up having the result of increasing your input costs, which means that you, in order to capture that profit, you have to also take on more overhead and more debt.
Which goes directly to a question that I came up with just in reading the book, is it seems like everything that makes a farmer's life easier, like auto steer or great databases or higher yield crops, is matched by something that also adds complexity.
That's right. And this is the thing that I think is truly remarkable, is that all of the skills that we associate with farming from 100 years ago are still necessary. You still have to know how to handle animals, and you have to know how to repair equipment, often by hand. But you also now also have to repair or have to be able to anticipate all of the sort of the business side of the operation, from commodities trading to the science of different hybrids and different genetically modified varieties. And to have that full set of skills is a really, really rare thing. And what it means is that there's always more and more pressure for young people who are considering farming to look at it and say, you know, maybe there's an easier life for me someplace else, which keeps diminishing the number of people who are involved in farming, which, of course, then also drives the need for more mechanization, more technology to keep that production up with fewer people.
So, I mean, obviously anybody in the business knows that farming's never going to be easy. I mean, from what the technology has done so far, it certainly has made some things easier, but again, added complexity. So at more or less the end of his farming career, does Rick Hammond have any regrets? Does he wish he had stayed a ski bum in Colorado or had just done something else with his life rather than work the farm?
I think these things are always incredibly hard, and you know, I think Rick has a number of specific regrets, but I think that what he regrets most is how much he got caught up in the need to compete with neighbors and with other farmers in order to try to be the top yielder or the person who had the new technology first. And in talking to Rick, he's often said that, you know, doing those things came at quite a cost to his family. And quite apart from the financial cost, always being in debt and always being needing to produce in order to service that debt meant that there was often a lot of pressure and just a lot of stress for the family.
Definitely a sense of being on a treadmill here, but a fascinating look at family farming in York County, Nebraska, right there between Grand Island and Lincoln. The book is called This Blessed Earth, A Year in the Life of an American Family Farm. It's the work of Ted Genoways. Ted, thanks so much for joining us today in The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
All right, take care.